Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my colleague and co-host, Sam Wong.
Hey there, this is Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience and molecular biology, also founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
So this is our first official broadcast, I'd say, of the midterm season. It's finally here. I think now that we're in mid-September, we can officially say the campaigns have begun. The stakes are huge. The consequences of what happens in November, I think, can have a big effect on this presidency, and some would say on the condition of our democracy. And as we record this, Washington right now is in the middle of a big scandal that's rocking the city that can have big implications on the midterms, the Supreme Court nomination of Brett Kavanaugh, which was a sure thing about a week ago, is now in jeopardy because of allegations that have emerged about his sexually assaulting a woman in high school. And there's a lot of speculation now, both what will happen when both of them testify about this, and also how it will play out in an electorate where this issue can really fuel some of the challenges that Republicans are already facing. And of course, all the stories keep getting worse for President Trump, which already had—
How is that possible?
Provided some, right, but it had provided more data on the potential of a blue wave. So what kind of midterm are we looking at? And I thought let's start our discussion with that. And maybe with Kavanaugh, curious to hear, Sam, what you think. Obviously, we don't know what's going to happen when she testifies and when he testifies about this. But what do you think we're potentially looking at in terms of how this week could affect the midterms?
Well, let's see. As we're recording this, these things often get dated. But as we're recording this, there's going to be a hearing. And the only people who are going to testify at that hearing are Brett Kavanaugh and his accuser. And so they're currently the only two witnesses. We'll see whether that holds up. As of the recording this, the nominee is still Kavanaugh. We don't know whether it's going to be Amy Coney Barrett or Thapar in the future or whoever. But right now, it's Kavanaugh. So look, whenever one party is behind going into midterms or going into any election, attention starts building up after Labor Day. And polling numbers, for whatever reason, either pollsters may change their methods slightly or people start tuning in after the summer, poll numbers start to move a little bit. So really, based on whatever evidence we have of public opinion, which is, you know, we have to question how accurate that evidence is, but based on any measurable evidence, this is the time that matters. And what that means is that either party would like to either continue the narrative or to upend the narrative. And so a fairly typical thing that might happen would be, say, for instance, adding noise and confusing people by bringing up irrelevant things. Like that might, given the current news environment, it might be to Republicans' advantage to just insert a news story, whether the news story might be slamming on a celebrity or being about Trump's tweet feed or what have you. Those are the kinds of things that can reset the story. And I would say at this point, it's pretty safe to say that controlling the narrative is really pretty far out of the Republicans' hands unless Trump goes and I forget what country we might bomb next. I've lost track. I guess Iran. And so basically the dynamic is that there's this movement towards November. Voters are watching their news feeds or not watching their news feeds, whatever it is they're doing. And I can tell you that if you look at, for instance, at House generic preferences, they've been hovering in favor of Democrats retaking the House up until the end of the summer. And right around the end of August, beginning of September, they ticked up. Before the Labor Day holiday, the median over at the Princeton Election Consortium, which is at election.princeton.edu, the median was hovering around 6 or 7% national popular vote favoring Democrats because of various factors, including gerrymandering. That's just barely enough to give them the edge for controlling the House, because they need to get at least a 6% popular vote win. But as of Labor Day weekend, that jumped up to the vicinity of 9%. And 9% is pretty good. That's, to use a sports analogy, that's they're now up by a touchdown. And so things are looking, you know, reasonably strong for the House. And all animal spirits on both sides, Democrat or Republican, there seems to be a pretty strong view on both sides that it's a pretty unfavorable environment for the president's party, the Republicans.
Yeah, so, it's hard to imagine this doesn't have a pretty detrimental effect in that environment. I mean, if this nomination is short-circuited, if these stories or these accounts seem pretty credible, and many feel that they are, this will, you know, it plays into some of the worst problems the Republicans are already facing, in large part because of President Trump, kind of a culmination of where this all was going. It start, you know, the emergence of the Me Too movement, the Women's March, and here we go into the fall, and these accusations come out against the nominee. I wouldn't be surprised if we learn more about how much of this was known while the Republicans were moving at a fast and furious pace to get the nomination through. But it's hard to imagine this won't increase the damage with the suburban educated women who have been mobilizing more than almost anyone for months for this midterm. And here comes this story about the nominee.
Right. Viewed through the lens of who's been moved by the political events of the last 2 years, really suburban women. I mean, that's just a huge reaction. White women, women of color, I guess women of color were already there, but movement among white women, basically seeing events. And I have to say, it really plays into, one could not have asked for a story that illustrated the fissures of the last 2 years, as well as what's happening with Kavanaugh right now.
I guess the only way the narrative changes, and this is genuine curiosity as someone who observes this at this point and doesn't fully have a grasp of how this dynamic works, is if, I mean, the news cycle and public discussions of any issue are so fleeting. You know, these hearings will happen next week. Say the nomination ends at that point, there's a withdrawal of the nomination. Does the news move on? Or in our political world, can these things reverberate beyond the coverage of a crisis, scandal, or whatever you want to call it?
Yeah.
We're September. Will this last till November? That's what I guess I'm asking.
Right. Well, there's things we don't know right now as of this taping, as of this recording. So, for instance, there was this letter of support for Kavanaugh that was signed by 65 women and got released right after this this allegation came up, before we knew Professor Ford's name. And at that time, you know, how did that letter come out so quickly? Well, some allegation was in the works, and the Republicans on the Judiciary Committee were evidently ready for this, which is kind of interesting that they knew about this. They knew about some problem with Kavanaugh and women, and they were sitting on the letter waiting to release it. Here's an example of what we don't know. We don't know that this is the same thing that they were worried about. Like, you know, I don't know. Maybe there's another one. I'm just speculating. And another example of what we don't know is that so many documents have not been reviewed because Kavanaugh has such a long record working in government and working for courts. We don't really know. There's a lot we don't know about him because those documents are currently unavailable. We don't know why he had a $200,000 debt a few years ago that seemed to have suddenly disappeared. And so there's this weird level of lack of knowledge. And public support for Kavanaugh before these allegations broke was at 38% for confirmation. Now, it's been pointed out by conservative commentators. I was reading that David French over at National Review, I believe, was pointing out that, in fact, government does not work by public opinion polls. Okay, that's a fair statement, but it is really weird for a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court, which is a major branch of government. It's really weird for the confirmation process to be so divisive that up until recently, the odds-on favorite for confirmation did not have majority support among voters. So we're in a really weird place right now, and I would not want to be Brett Kavanaugh at the moment.
And it's kind of incredible to try to think about, if Republicans knew this was out there, what exactly they were thinking. I mean, this nomination was so important for them ideologically. It was so important for the party politically. It was probably their best Trump card, so to speak, to try to mitigate some of the damage the president has caused and increase the enthusiasm. And did the party think this was going to you know, not emerge before the confirmation was finished? Did they think somehow they can subvert the entire story if it came out just through that letter with all the signatures? I'm not clear on what the Republican leadership, Mitch McConnell, and even people in the Trump administration were thinking as they put this forward.
Yeah, it's weird. It's almost like we have – the way I see this is that if you look at demographics, if you look at the way the elections have gone the last – let's back up now, like now, let's say 10 or 20 years, the nation is closely divided, and the Republican Party has been very good at using rules to get advantage, whether it goes back to Bush v. Gore, whether it's blocking the nomination of Merrick Garland, whether it's the election of Donald Trump. That's a party that's very strategic and good at running campaigns. Whatever one may think about their messaging, they're good at it. But they're also on the edge of not having power because they it's at this point arguably necessary for them to use all these manipulations in order to gain power in a country where they didn't have majority support at the level of the presidency 2 years ago. And yet they're on the verge of losing the House. And so what I would say is that any time a party, never mind which party it is, if a party's on the edge of losing power, then they may become desperate to get what they wanted. And if you think about the major priorities of the Republican Party, correct me if I'm wrong, but I would characterize the major priorities as being that big tax cut that that got rammed through last year, and now the Supreme Court. And this is a major priority for them. And so for this to slip away or be even threatened with being slipping away, it does raise the question of why they would nominate Kavanaugh, because at least from what we know, other choices might have been safer. Amy Coney Barrett, who has, who in her own way is, you know, an inspirational story from a non-elite school, highly religious, views that are anathema to a lot of people on the Democratic side, but seems to be kind of more an inspirational story. Or Thapar, this another justice, I'm sure I'm saying his name wrong. These people who could have been safer choices, and instead this guy who, well, I guess he told Trump that. That he thought that the executive was immune from prosecution. And so I don't know, maybe that was kind of appealing.
Although Democrats might want to remember, you know, I could imagine if this falls apart and it falls apart quickly, the Republicans push through fast and furious one of these other choices and you end up on the court that's just as conservative, if not more conservative. And I wouldn't put it past McConnell to do that.
Well, okay, so
that can be the unintended consequence here.
But let's get away from horse race for a second. So one thing is okay. So first, one question is: are they really going to try to push through the next one with the amount of speed that they pushed through Kavanaugh? Certainly, that's possible. But another question is: in terms of moving the ball back and forth across the field between liberal and conservative, one could espouse a more traditional value, which is that we should expect our leaders to not be beset by improprieties, by scandals, by corruption, by owing his or her appointment to a president who is himself being investigated. And so purely on good government grounds, is it really a good idea to bring a second person to the Supreme Court who is accused of, in the first case, Clarence Thomas, sexual harassment, in this case, sexual assault? On those grounds alone, maybe it would be better to not have someone like that on the court. And sure, there is the question of moving the court to the left or to the right, coming up with someone who's, you know, more reliable on whatever might be, restricting civil rights or aiding, you know, abetting the role of money in politics. Those are, of course, policy outcomes that matter a lot under normal conditions. But purely on moral grounds, is it really advisable for there to be 2 out of 5 Republican appointees on the Supreme Court with such a, you know, odious cloud?
Now, that's true. But I also wonder if there's a level of hubris in the GOP that sets in.
Pride or desperation? I guess both.
From controlling the rules and their effectiveness of doing that. Yeah. So I do think Senator McConnell, there's part of him who thinks he can get what he wants quietly, but he will get it. And there might be an aspect of
– and he might get it, right? I mean
– and he might get it. And there might be an aspect – there might be a way in which the Trump's ability to move – to break all norms and at some level survive – at least in the short term, gives Republicans the impression that indeed none of this stuff really matters, that that's a myth of convention. It's a myth of how we think of how politics should work, but the rules have changed. But it might actually be the rules haven't changed as much. That's what Greg Sargent of the Washington Post writes, some really good stuff, challenging people who say Trump's getting away with things, and people are overstating how much Teflon president we have there, because the polls show, in fact, he's not doing well. The Republicans are actually suffering. And so there might be a dynamic where Republicans don't see that, and now they're going to start paying the price. I don't know, but it's on my mind as I watch how this unfolds.
Well, we've talked about this before. I would characterize it as follows. Rhetoric has gotten louder, and the norms of governance have become more extreme and gotten violated. We hear about all kinds of there's even secondary scandals that we don't hear about, like things involving Wilbur Ross over the Commerce Department or the FEMA administrator who seems to be someone indifferent to federal government's role in Puerto Rico. There are all these things bubbling around underneath the surface, but I would characterize it as follows. Opinion is moving less and less, and Trump's volatility, and I don't mean his personal volatility, which is kind of funny to think of, but in terms of his popularity, approval numbers for Trump move very little up and down, despite all this incredible noise in politics. If you look at the volatility of Trump's approval rating as measured by Gallup, his first-term approval has moved up and down. That volatility is lower than any president than Eisenhower's first term. Now, obviously, Trump is super unpopular, and Eisenhower was super popular. Eisenhower was around 70%. Yeah. But the volatility is similar. And the fact that we have to go back to basically the Korea War era to find a president whose ratings were as steady as Trump's tells you that people have chosen up sides. The dialing up of rhetoric and the immobility of opinion, I would submit, are probably closely related. So yes, the rules have changed, but the rules are changed because we're in this extreme place in U.S. politics. But if pollsters are telling us accurate information, and they're still within a few points, they were even within a few points 2 years ago, if they're anywhere close to the truth, then opinion, people have chosen up sides, and we're heading for what looks like it might be a pretty, might be a pretty bad election for the Republicans, maybe the worst in 40 years.
And even in places it's looking now, like Arizona and Tennessee, in Senate races, Democrats are in pretty good shape, or at least right now they are, for potentially winning these seats.
Yes, it is somewhat shocking. Yes. I would say the swing states right now for the Senate are currently not Arizona. I mean, sure, it's going to be a close race in Arizona, but early indications are, I guess it's not so early now, it looks like the Democrat, Kyrsten Sinema, is looking pretty strong for taking that seat, taking Jeff Flake's seat. There are other states where it looked like it was going to be pretty bleak for Democrats, and, it's looking less bleak now by a long shot.
And that's a big price to pay. There's not a lot of midterms where you have those kinds of swings.
Yeah. Well, on the one, right.
Not just the competitive places, but all of a sudden the places that should be owned by the party of the president no longer are. That's a really big price if that happens,
right,
for the GOP to have owned Trump and to have been so loyal to him.
Yeah. So, it's generally the case that very close races largely break for one party or the other. And so polls are going to be off by a few points. Midterm polling error is actually pretty large. It can be up to 5 points. At least that's what it's been in the last midterm election in 2014. The across-the-board polling error was about 5 points. And that's large enough that a lot of these races are going to break one way or the other. And so I guess one possibility is that Republicans win most of these races, I suppose, if they play this right and they somehow turn the Kavanaugh thing into riling up their own base. I guess I can imagine by some kind of logic, maybe they could win most of these races. But it seems more likely to me that Democrats will win more of these races. Now, that having been said, we don't know.
Why is the margin of error so large for midterm?
It's just hard to gauge turnout. It's really hard to know. To first order in a presidential year, most people are going to vote. Turnout is tens of points lower in an off year, and so pollsters have to make judgments about who's likely to vote or not. How enraged are white suburban women? How much are Republican diehards going to vote for their president's party? And those are examples of major unknowns. Lots of African Americans turned out for Barack Obama. Without an African American at the top of the ticket, how will people in that community vote? And so estimating turnout is just a tough art for pollsters, and they do amazingly well on average, but midterms are tough. And so what looks like right now a near tie in Missouri or in Tennessee might not be a tie by the time November comes around. And we are just in suspense right now.
That's really important. And I think probably most people don't realize that. And so the volatility that we have seen, I mean, there's been a certain amount of volatility in these polls, in that, you know, one day we hear blue wave, the next day might not be a blue wave, and then we're back to blue wave. That could be real. I mean, that could be a genuine game.
Yeah, this is the way I would put it. I would characterize the usual game in interpreting polls is to ask who's up, who's down, and to look at the volatility moving up and down. And I would characterize us as being in what I would call, from a physics standpoint, the heat death of politics, where actually the amount of movement is not very large. But there's this big thing happening that we don't know about, which is that polls may be moving by little ticks up and down, but where the polls land can be off, and that's what a math person calls systematic error. And so there could be a pretty large systematic error at the end. And so I would say that it's actually a good year to not look at polls and to just say Democrats could end up with anywhere between 48 and 53 seats in the Senate. I realize that's a large range. It's probably going to be in the middle of that range. I wouldn't be surprised if they ended up with, say 50 to 52 seats. So it's a range that happens to include Republicans retaining control and picking up a couple of seats. And it's also a range that includes Democrats picking up substantial seats. And the problem is that the polling data is probably not the right thing to look at, because there's this giant finger that gets put on the scale at the end, and polls aren't going to capture that.
It also means that these events really can be consequential. So in contrast to what we often hear in presidential races, that the game change moments are far and few between, because it's hard to really reverse course for where things would be now in a presidential election. In midterms, given the kinds of things that drive turnout, there's still a lot of room for something like how this Kavanaugh confirmation unfolds, or what President Trump does, next month. They could really have a big effect on this turnout. And so it is pretty dynamic between now and November. And these events are consequential on how the electorate's going to react come voting day.
Yeah. And as I said, I think one couldn't rule out the possibility that having a Supreme Court nomination on voters' minds in the next month or so, despite the allegation of sexual assault, despite what we're going to learn about Brett Kavanaugh's character, this might be motivating for Republican voters, because right now there's an enthusiasm gap. If you look at strongly approve and strongly disapprove numbers, strongly disapproves for President Trump outnumber by about 2-1 strongly approves. So right now, as long as the focus is on Donald Trump, I think that's pretty adverse for the Republicans. But if the focus becomes the Supreme Court, I don't know. Like this is what a lot of them wanted all along. They wanted to get that fifth reliable vote for Federalist Society principles. It's a priority for them, and putting Brett Kavanaugh front and center might be just what the doctor ordered to pull them out of the toilet.
And part of it will depend on the nature, literally how the testimony unfolds.
Yeah.
Because whatever is said, there will be a contingent of Republicans who will argue this is character assassination. It's based on memory and innuendo, and they will try to use this as a way to motivate that voter turnout, saying what Democrats will do, and this is how they will stifle a court. So part of their ability to do that, even in red areas, will really depend on what people see and hear next week. It's an interesting moment.
I still don't get why don't they just move on to the next person? This guy Kavanaugh, right? We're hearing this about him. His high school buddy Mark Judge has written a whole memoir about what it was like to be a high school blackout drunk. Kavanaugh himself has made a fond, nostalgic speech for what it was like to get ragingly drunk while at Yale Law School. There are enough shadows at this point that if they wanted their policy priorities, it just it seems like the ones who want to drag this out and really get this into the public eye at this point are probably the Democrats. Like, I don't know, like if you're Kamala Harris, then this is great. I mean, great in the sense that you're not great in the sense that you want it to happen, but great in the sense that, okay, let's have that conversation.
Well, it's either no strategy or a strategy we don't see, meaning either this is the story of the era where the party, you know, is simply standing firm, is simply blinded to the costs of what they are doing, and you know, won't budge.
Yeah.
And that's just where Republicans are. There is no grand strategy. It's
right.
Just stuck in a mess and making it worse. Or the other alternative is there's a strategy. This is a setup, you know, either to move on after this to someone really conservative, pin the Democrats for character assassination, quote unquote, use this to mobilize people. I have no idea which it is.
I think McConnell's just left holding. I think McConnell's left holding the bag. He's just stuck in this situation and he's got to make the best of it. And the way to make the best of it is to deny everything, you know, not for Kavanaugh to express contrition, but to act as if he has no idea what this is about. And I think that's probably their, you know, it's probably their best strategy, I guess, I suppose.
Trump was remarkably contained, though, saying that they're he still defended him, but he didn't go at least so far as we're recording this on a major tirade and said that they should let the process play out, which was really odd to hear from him.
Yeah, I think that actually, my reaction when I heard that was, rut-row. I think that could be pretty bad for Kavanaugh, that the most that the White House can muster is we have to let it play out. Like, geez, you know, like if I were accused of something horrible and you were to say, well, I still think that Sam is a great guy, but we just have to let the process play out. You know, my reaction would be, thanks, Julian. So
right. And coming from President Trump in particular, that's even more of a tell.
Yeah.
Because his instinct is always to react, fight, and to simply rip into the opposition. And at least so far, he didn't do that, which is really, if you're playing poker with him, you know, you have to see that as a sign in terms of what cards he's holding here.
Yeah, so, I think there's a certain stench of death surrounding the Kavanaugh nomination right now.
Yeah, I still predict, though, if this falls apart, they're going to move fast with someone even more right wing, even at least that they think is cleaner.
And sure.
Try to actually rebound to their benefit.
Of course, they've been. The Federalist Society has been working for decades, growing judges in hydroponic tanks to be reliable for their principles. And so the inside scuttlebutt among court watchers has been that there were four or five people who seemed appropriate. Some are former Kennedy clerks, and so we think about people named Kethledge. There's Hardiman.
Right.
Thapar, as I said before, Coney Barrett, they have people lined up. And, you know, we don't know much about those people either. I'd like to think that for confirming someone to the Supreme Court, we have some actual deliberation of these people's records. But you know, like surely one of them is not accused of sexual assault.
We'll see.
Well, no, multiple ones. I mean, I'm sorry. That was flippant of me. But like, I mean, look, I just like these. They have better choices.
Right. Right. No, absolutely. We're almost out of time, but let me put you on the spot. Now that we're in September, we're talking midterms. What's one midterm that you have your eye on, either House or Senate, that you think is interesting or telling?
Oh, let's see. So in the House side, I'm super interested in a race that's close to us. There's a former Obama administration official, Tom Malinowski, who's running to unseat Leonard Lance in the New Jersey 7th District. Also close to us, there's a former Rhodes Scholar, another former Obama guy, Andy Kim, looking to unseat Tom MacArthur, another Republican incumbent in New Jersey. Something like a quarter of the seats needed to retake the House from the Democrats' point of view are in New Jersey, Pennsylvania. So, you know, I'm keeping it local because I think that, broadly speaking, I think anyone who should be watching politics right now, anyone who's interested right now, should be keeping it local and just keeping it in their neighborhood. And so for me, those are local races.
That's a good, I think that's both good examples, but also a good way to think of it. And You know, too often, I think people like to focus on a few high profile races somewhere in the country rather than what's going on in their own backyards. Yeah. And that's probably a better feel for where things are. Yeah.
Now, I am watching Senate races, though.
The Senate races are interesting. I'm still looking at Tennessee to go against.
Same. Your own advice. Yeah. Yeah. What's your take on Tennessee?
I mean, he's ahead. It's pretty consistent. And if he can beat her,
Marsha Blackburn,
he can beat Marsha Blackburn, who's kind of a Trumpian Republican in Tennessee. I think that's a good place to start to see the real costs of President Trump.
Well, he's ahead, but not by a lot. I would say that if you look at the last three polls, he's up by 5-1. He's up by 2 in another one. And she, Marsha Blackburn, is up by 3. So I would say, you know, Phil Bredesen, the Democrat, former mayor of Memphis, I'd say he's slightly favored to win. And if he ends up pulling that one out, that I would say would be one of three key races Democrats need to take control of the Senate. I think the fact that he's making it close tells you what a bleak year it is for Republicans at the national level.
Yeah.
I'd throw in Indiana and Missouri. I think those are worth watching as well.
Although before we end, I have to remind everyone, after 94 and the Republicans took over Congress, you know, President Clinton was reelected in 96. And same with Obama after the 2010 midterm. So I think people should remember this is about the balance of power. It's about control of Congress, but it's not necessarily a read of where things are going to go in 2020. I'm going to end on that positive note.
I think Democrats should start laying out policy priorities. That's what I think.
All right. Thanks to everyone. And you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. Thanks for joining us. And we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Goodbye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.